than similar courses, and only a quarter of those who registered asked for their money back. But Trump University was certainly not one of Donald's cleverer moves, and he must surely regret ever having launched such a shabby enterprise. The real fruit of the branding initiative was harvested in letting out the name Trump for ambitious buildings and building complexes all over the world. Though not without controversy either, this was a mighty bonanza. It was an absolute no-lose game for Donald Trump, and its invention must stand as one of his many remarkable accomplishments. He lent his name to projects, required an upfront payment, and demanded that as an investor, he be put first in line among creditors, and had no shortage of suitors. It must perpetually astound the large gallery of his detractors, who have been repulsed for decades that anyone would pay anything to identify with Trump, but many did, and for many, it was a wise investment. In support of his franchisees, to adapt slightly the normal commercial ambit of the word, Donald Trump sometimes implied or even affirmed that his investments in projects bearing his name were much greater than they really were. The most embarrassing example of this was when Trump wrote of the Trump International Hotel and Tower in Waikiki, Honolulu, in a letter published in the Wall Street Journal on November 28, 2007, that this building is largely owned by me and is being developed by me. In fact, he had no equity interest in the building, nor was he or his company managing it. In a deposition required in a subsequent legal proceeding, he claimed that he had such a strong licensing agreement that it's a form of ownership. This was bunk, of course, but like so many of the ungent liberties he has taken in smoothing his career forward, it is not exactly a lie, though it lends enhanced elasticity to his notion of truthful hyperbole. There were many other discrepancies between what was strongly implied as the level of Trump's participation in projects and the facts. It is a credit to his record as a quality builder that the use of his name was so prized by developers, lenders, and unit buyers or tenants. His contracts lending his name to projects generally were extremely advantageous to him, giving him authority over design to assure quality, and leaving him a complete right to walk if the developer faltered or if Trump decided that he was not adhering to Trump standards. There were many legal problems with disgruntled participants in unsuccessful projects, but Trump had plausible deniability in all cases. Despite the allegations of his enemies and the assorted aggrieved, it was caveat emptor, and he was selling his brand, not guaranteeing performance. And his presence did provide at least a partial assurance that the project would meet fairly high standards. It wouldn't win the gold star of the Better Business Bureau, but it was rarely the subject of successful litigation from complainants. It is only fair to emphasize that the great majority of these projects were successful, and that the Trump name added real value. It is easy, as Trump's enemies have done, to find the turkeys and highlight their often hilarious shortcomings and their impact on pitifully naive subscribers to the magic of the Trump name. But he never underwrote any of these projects, and most of his co-contractants were honest people who succeeded and felt their deals with Trump were valid transactions for received value. Donald Trump, the businessman, was very aggressive and took all corners on two wheels. But despite some ethical lapses, the licensing of his name to buildings and building projects was much more often than not successful for all parties involved. In 2007, he created the Trump Hotel Collection and roped in a group of genuine luxury hotels happy to put the Trump name atop them. Trump was targeting the most prosperous 5% of travelers, and between 2005 and 2015, his name sprouted up on grand new hotels in Baku, Dubai, Istanbul, Jakarta, Mexico City, Panama, Toronto, and elsewhere. Some, such as Baku and Panama, had a very troubled history. There were some that didn't get off the ground, but the Trump Hotel Collection was a reliable profit center to Trump. Like much of the outright promotional business, it was both clever and cheesy. Trump, a very good golfer, also lent his name to golf courses. Sentimentally attached to his mother's home country, his organization owns not one, but two golfing and resort complexes in Scotland, one of which in Aberdeen became terribly contentious because of Trump's vehement opposition to a government plan to build offshore wind turbines that he says would destroy the view. As ever, Trump insists that, controversies aside, he is in fact very popular in Scotland, and that while these investments have yet to move into the black, they eventually will, because of the enormous care he has taken in improving the properties, of which he is inordinately proud. Also controversial were Trump's forays into mortgages and health care, with Trump Mortgage and Trump Network. Trump Mortgage was launched in 2006, just as the mortgage market started to soften, before crashing altogether in the autumn of 2008. This new business was promising swift approvals of applications, but as conditions darkened, Trump took appropriate action to reduce his risk. And as defaults occurred, the volumes were not so numerous that his company had trouble seizing the encumbered properties and holding them until conditions had stabilized. He sold the name Trump Financial to Meridian Mortgage in 2007 and reverted to the sale of his name without risking any of his own money. Trump Network was a new name Trump sold to Ideal Health for a share of their revenue, which peddled a vitamin supplement based on analysis of the urine sample provided by buyers. With his customary profit-fueled enthusiasm, Donald Trump announced to a convention of thousands of users in Miami in 2009 that the Trump Network wants to give millions of people renewed hope with an exciting plan to opt out of the recession. Let's get out of this recession right now with cutting-edge health and wellness formulas and a system where you can develop your own financial independence. The Trump Network offers people the opportunity to achieve the American dream. In fact, it offered $139.95 for a year analysis, $69.95 monthly for the vitamins, and $99.95 for a follow-up year analysis every 6 months. It would be a little harsh to call it a scam, and subscription was voluntary, and nothing miraculous was promised, only hoped for. But it was another thoroughly questionable promotion. There were eventually a number of complaints, as was inevitable, and Trump withdrew from the venture when the licensing contract expired in 2011. He was not successfully sued, but it was another dodgy flim-flam operation that tarnished the emblazoned name, though doubtless at a profit, since, once again, he had not invested a penny. The next rollout of the equal opportunity, no-fault Trump publicity-generating machine was his foray into international wrestling, which cannot be confused with the continuation of authentic college, Greco-Roman, and Oriental wrestling, which are regulated sports. These are the extravaganzas of rigged matches with practically no rules, uproarious antics, and outrageous abuses of officials, but staffed by very talented performers, even if they are not entirely traditional sporting figures. The brilliant but outlandish impresario of wrestling, Vince McMahon, operator of the World Wrestling Federation, happy hunting ground of great celebrities and showmen like Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant, became a commercial friend of Trump's when Trump hosted WrestleMania at the Trump Plaza in Atlantic City in the late 1980s. They agreed to combine their crowd-gathering talents in a mighty roundup of the susceptible called the Battle of the Billionaires. They had a showdown in the Pontiac Silverdome in Detroit before almost 90,000 people on July 19, 2001. In what was portrayed as a contest of their great egos, they sponsored a wrestler to represent each of them in a grudge match to determine which of them was preeminent. They marched down the ramps, fully clothed, fortunately, to the ring, and strutted about like giant full-figured roosters before their proxies, the 270-pound Bobby Lashley for Trump and the 350-pound rippling mountain of tattoos Umaga the Samoan Bulldozer for McMahon. It was an extravaganza of unutterable hucksterism. At a fan appreciation night for McMahon a few weeks before in Dallas, pushing the great battle, Trump suddenly appeared on a huge overhead screen, and the crowd was littered with dollar bills fluttering down from the ceiling like miniature paratroopers. In another preparatory session, Trump apparently flipped McMahon over a table after a center ring exchange of vulgarities. After a few more of these warm-ups, the main event finally got going to an immense pay television audience, and Trump's wrestler won, enabling Trump to shear the hair off McMahon, which he did in a joint triumph of absurd histrionics. However fatuous the whole business may have been, Trump enjoyed himself, communicated very well with the low-end blue-collar and juvenile following of the sport, and tucked away another fine profit on an initial investment of zero. Apart from the money, Trump was opening up a following with an entirely new echelon of the public who would no more have thought that a man of his wealth and education would get involved in wrestling and all its nonsense than that David Rockefeller would appear in a prize fight in Madison Square Garden. It was a remarkably ambitious and imaginative course for Trump to broaden his base in the multi-layered, intensely cross-threaded society of America, for whatever unspecified ultimate purposes he might choose. He was also already well embarked on an ambitious schedule as an inspirational speaker, receiving $100,000 per session, telling packed houses how to bootstrap themselves up from obscurity, pick themselves up after a serious setback such as he had endured, and reach for the top. He was giving a couple or more of these speeches most months, and it was another profit center, but also another way for him to meet the public and tap into the opinions and thoughts of middle-class, want-to-get-ahead Americans. He leveraged his celebrity for cameo roles in other well-known television programs outside The Apprentice, including Sex and the City and Saturday Night Live, the latter of which, nevertheless, has been extremely hostile to him as president. Comedy Central tendered him a full roast, where he showed he could absorb the most barbed ridicule of his many foibles, and he responded with self-deprecating egomania, comparing his hair to a wet raccoon and saying, "It must be a great honor for you to honor me tonight." The only barb Trump could not abide was the charge that he was not really a wealthy man. One of Trump's advantages was his versatility and his willingness, indeed eagerness, to appeal to widely different sections of people. Most celebrities are famous for one thing. They are political or religious leaders, military heroes, movie or television stars, great athletes, or even scientific figures like Einstein. Trump was different because Trump became famous for a trait, success, an achievement, wealth, and more or less simultaneously as a mark of quality in everything from hotels and casinos to golf courses to wine. He was a developer, a TV star, and even something of a sage, authoring books on success, giving lectures, and unafraid to comment on politics. Trump's garishness and gaucherie often blinds his critics to his talents, which are as manifold as his offenses are to their sensibilities. His critics, even at time of writing, are not perceptive observers. They are straight men in a monstrous send-up of conventional opinion, tumbled over and rendered absurd in the mighty updraft of the main event of Trump's career. To a man of Donald Trump's self-confidence, the idea of his becoming president of the United States was not at all outrageous. He had brushed shoulders with politicians and met presidents, and he was not at all intimidated by them, and did not believe that they had any special powers or talents or mystique that he lacked. In fact, he had qualities that some of them didn't. He was a rich celebrity, whose tastes were not to hobnob with the swells and socially eminent benefactors, but crucially for a presidential candidate, to harvest the affection of the lower, middle, and working classes of America, who were not appalled, but rather to some degree inspired by his bravura, buffoonery, and raw egotism. For behind it, they saw an outrageously successful version of themselves, and one who, they intuited, understood them in their desires, fears, and hopes. It was in this period that this author first got to know Donald Trump beyond mere social pleasantries. My associates and I owned the Chicago Sun-Times and its low-rise building on the Chicago River, just south of the Wrigley Tower. The building was an obvious candidate for redevelopment, which to us was a potential source of windfall profit. We commenced a normal bid process, and as Trump appeared to be the competitive winner, our American directors all warned me to keep my hand on the company's wallet, that Trump was a scoundrel who could not be relied upon for anything. We were accordingly cautious and vigilant when he was the winning bidder, and followed advice to assure that he could not lay off on us any superfluous expenses, such as jet fuel bills for his airplane. But he came in on budget all the way through, and there were no significant issues. He started out promising to build the world's tallest building. But after the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center, he scaled the project back to about 1,270 feet, still an imposing sight on the skyline. He delivered exactly what he had promised under our contract, and it is a generally admired building, 98 stories designed by the distinguished firm Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, and undoubtedly built to an extremely high standard. Donald and Melania came voluntarily to our annual shareholders meeting in 2003, and he intervened to speak very flatteringly of the manner in which my associates and I had conducted our side of the complex negotiations over the Chicago property. And I will say that I found Trump a good deal more ethical and honest than many other businessmen and corporate directors I have known. Melania was charming, and her arrival in Donald's life seemed to settle him. Trump's marriage to Marla Maples had semi-publicly broken down in syncopated lurches, as it had begun, but without public acrimony. Donald had happened upon Melania Knaus at the famous Kit Kat Club in 1998, and was so astounded by her startling beauty and sultry, confident poise that he effectively ditched his date, the formidably attractive and capable Norwegian businesswoman and bearer of a famous name in that country, despite its awkwardness in English, Selena Middelfart. Melania modeled her way out of a late socialist Slovenia to Milan, then Paris, and in the mid-1990s, New York. She seems to have led a fairly restrained private life, and has had no difficulty silencing media that have insinuated otherwise, collecting, as has been mentioned, £2.5 million from the London Daily Mail in 2014, for writing that she had something to do with an escort service. Once she was Trump's companion, she had a relaxed view of the relationship, as in her cameo appearance on Howard Stern's radio program, confirming the couple's robust sex life. She appeared on the cover of the British edition of GQ in January 2000, lying sideways on a bed in Trump's airplane, naked except for diamond jewelry, with the headline, "Sex at 30,000 Feet. Melania Knaus earns her air miles." Donald and Melania were married at Palm Beach's Bethesda-by-the-Sea Episcopalian Church on January 22, 2005. This and the Roman Catholic St. Edward's Church, just beyond the Breakers Hotel and Everglades Club to the north, are two of America's better-known society churches. The events board in front of Bethesda a few weeks before the Trump wedding had announced a visiting homilist who would speak on the theme, "The Lord is my shepherd, even in Palm Beach." The denomination was apparently a compromise between Donald's Presbyterianism, which doesn't have a suitable church in Palm Beach, and Melania's Roman Catholicism, where marriage to a twice-divorced man would have required a few prior formalities before it could be conducted in a church. It was a packed congregation, studded with celebrities from the entertainment, media, casino, and political worlds, including the Clintons, but with little representation from the couple's neighbors in the great salons of Fifth and Park Avenues and South Ocean Boulevard. The author's wife had a very convivial conversation with flamboyant promoter and impresario Don Only in America King, who was sitting just behind us in the church before the bridegroom appeared, looking very serious with a slight pout and his soon-to-be-famous contumelious lip. A very grand reception went very late at Mar-a-Lago. The relationship has apparently lasted smoothly for nearly 20 years and has produced Donald Trump's fifth offspring and third son, Barron, the name he gave himself on the telephone when pretending to be his own public relations advisor during previous marital problems. Melania is a devoted mother, ignores the snide imbecilities of her husband's media lampooners, and is well-liked and respected by the public, and always makes an excellent and tastefully glamorous impression when she goes abroad. She is neither an employee of her husband, nor a rival, nor a scene stealer. She is neither cloying nor bossy. She is confident and relaxed, cool and poised, looks whimsically on some of her husband's eccentricities, but is always very supportive. Her English is markedly accented, but perfectly fluent and comprehensible, She speaks several other languages also. She exudes an exotic and mysterious composure that is often more becoming than the opinionated and busy nature of some of her recent predecessors as First Lady. She never appears to the public to be either short-tempered or over-eager to please or impress. Her only historic rival as a glamorous chatelaine in the White House is Jackie Kennedy. The decks were already fairly clear for Donald Trump to try his theories of celebrity in a race for president, but he would have to be patient. He was seeking the office, not the other way around. Chapter 5. Preparing to Seek the Grand Prize. Trump had supported George W. Bush for president in 2000, though he wasn't especially active in the campaign. Like most Americans, he enthusiastically backed the president's energetic policy against terrorism after the September 11, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. He claims to have disapproved of the Iraq War of 2003, though earlier he had said to Howard Stern that he guessed he would approve such a war, which was unleashed 6 months later. That is a reconcilable position, and he was prescient in describing the war as botched just a few days after it began. In any case, when Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and the appointed Iraq Administrator Paul Bremer dissolved the armed forces and police of Iraq and told the 400,000 people involved that they were unemployed and without benefit but could keep their weapons and munitions, it is hard not to wonder what they were thinking. Trump was already a war critic by the time this ordinance took hold, and he remained so. A strong advocate of fighting terrorists, defending the international interests of the United States, but not of plunging unthinkingly into foreign wars, and not of taking on the task of building democratic states where there was no precedent or fertile ground for one. Having opposed the Iraq War more or less in the first place, Trump was appalled, as were most Americans, at the fiscal, strategic, and humanitarian disasters that Bush and Obama had managed to fashion from it. By 2008, Trump's own extensive polling confirmed and amplified other polls, which showed that the country, suffering from war fatigue, big government republicanism, and a looming economic crisis, was disgusted with the performance of all branches of their government except the military. The whole political battle in 2008 was for the Democratic Party nomination between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, as the banking crisis and the ensuing Great Recession, as well as the interminable open sore of the Iraq War, assured the defeat of the Republican nominee, Senator John McCain, who, though a distinguished man, was an inept blunderbuss as a presidential candidate. Obama's masterly victory over Hillary Clinton offered Americans the opportunity to put the racism of their national past behind them by electing him their president, which they happily did twice, given the Republican alternatives on offer, first McCain and then the equally inept Mitt Romney. Some space must be allowed for the maturation of Trump's political judgment during this period. He has been taxed, for instance, for having sent Democrat Elliot Spitzer a handwritten letter of congratulations when he was elected Attorney General of New York in 1998, and for having supported Spitzer when he successfully ran for governor of New York in 2006. Spitzer was a very belligerent and draconian prosecutor who didn't hesitate to intimidate boards of directors of a target with threats of spurious indictments, and as governor was forced to resign in 2008 after a prostitution scandal, taking with him the sympathy of no one. Trump described Spitzer in 2013 as a horrible governor and attorney general. This has been cited as evidence of Trump's inconstancy, but that is not a reasonable conclusion. It came 15 years after Trump's congratulations to Spitzer on being elected state attorney general, and is not an unjustified opinion of Spitzer's performance in office. Moreover, while Trump's political views remained largely constant, his party affiliation did not, as he tried to find and support a party that reflected his own beliefs. Trump changed political parties no less than 7 times between 1999 and 2012. Trump initially saluted Barack Obama's qualities as a gifted politician when he was elected a United States senator from Illinois. But Trump became a sharp critic of Obama as president and was one of the leaders in the early 2012 polls to take the Republican Party nomination and challenge Obama, then running for re-election. Not content with attacks on Obamacare and other elements of Obama's rather thin record of accomplishment, Trump embarked on the harebrained allegation that Obama was not eligible to hold the office of president because he was not born an American. Obama finally produced his long-form birth certificate, and the whole issue collapsed. Obama drew extensive laughter when he asked, in Trump's presence at the annual Washington Correspondents' Dinner in 2012, if Trump would now move on to the question of, did we fake the moon landing? The comments rankled, but Trump declined to run for president in 2012 and instead campaigned for Mitt Romney and went to what he hoped would be Romney's victory party in Boston on election night. He was apparently quite upset by the result and fired off a torrent of comments in his newly favored medium, Twitter, calling the election, in words that he would make familiar in another few years, a total sham and a travesty. He called upon Republicans to fight like hell and stop this great and disgusting injustice. We can't let this happen. The world is laughing at us. This is somewhat Trump's technique. If he didn't win, it was fixed, and then he will claim to have won anyway. In this case, he could claim victory by pointing to Republicans maintaining their majority in the House of Representatives. But he also had a more personal plan. Less than 2 weeks after the election, Trump filed a patent and trademark application on Reagan's slogan of 20 years before, "Make America Great Again." In 2012, Trump turned 66. If he was going to make a serious attempt to crown his career with the uniquely great office of President of the United States, it was 2016 or never. Issues on which he had experience and expertise, real estate via the housing bubble, banking, the economy, had risen to prominence. During the 1990s, Trump had watched in rising dismay as President Bill Clinton had inflated the housing bubble by executive order and legislation, enjoying the political benefit of increased homeownership at no apparent cost to the taxpayers, as well as the tangible gratitude of the building trade unions and real estate developers. As Trump was one of the country's greatest authorities on most aspects of real estate development, he was increasingly concerned with the problem, especially after his own recent debt crisis. And after the economy almost collapsed in 2008, he consoled himself with the spectacle of the bankers who had put him on the rack, crying like starving children for government assistance to avoid the complete failure of the banking system. It would have been a challenge to make Donald Trump a greater cynic than he already was about the claims of probity and impeccable motive of the captains of industry and capital. But the shambles of international finance in 2008 and following years managed it. The politicians from right to left who had enabled and fostered the crisis, led by Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush and Senator John McCain, locked arms and blamed the crisis on private sector greed, and then acquiesced in the legislative demand for greater powers to assist the federal government in preventing what had occurred, despite the fact that Congress, the president, and the federal bureaucracy already possessed all the powers they needed to avoid it, and in fact were the chief architects of the problem. In 2009, President Obama had entered office with a strong mandate and the goodwill of everyone, including Donald Trump, as the absurd and unjust color barrier to the nation's highest office was shattered. Indicative of the wave of hope that accompanied him into office, and for a time after, was the award on October 9, 2009, not 9 months into his presidency, of the Nobel Prize for Peace. The reason given was his extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy and relations between peoples. This was nonsense. And the secretary of the Norwegian Nobel Association, Geir Lundestad, stated 6 years later that the award was an attempt to strengthen Obama's position and not a reward for anything he had done, and that it was a mistake. George W. Bush's trigger-happy war-making and nation-building, capped out by the economic debacle of the housing debt crisis and Great Recession, so demoralized America and the world that the articulate, suave Obama, representing multi-ethnic tolerance and racial justice, was accepted at face value by almost everyone. This made the disappointment of his ineffectual performance in office more bitter. He enjoyed a respectable personal approval rating, probably because the country did not want to digest the thought that the first non-white president was not a good president. But in fact, he was not. Polls revealed that the American people thought their country was on the wrong track and on a wide range of policy issues opposed President Obama. Objectively, the 20 years from 1996 to 2016 gave the country the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, and with the exception of the Great Depression, the worst since the 1870s, as well the worst peacetime public sector debt accumulation in American history, with only 1% per capita GDP growth to show for it. More than $1 trillion had been squandered in Iraq, to hand 3/5 of it over to Iranian influence and reduce the rest to violent civil and sectarian war. An oceanic flood of desperate refugees was loosed upon the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe, as the United States itself continued to admit unassimilated masses of illiterate Latin American peasants as undocumented migrants. Gross domestic product per capita growth declined from 4.5% in the last 6 Reagan years to 3.9% in the Clinton years to 2% under George W. Bush and 1% under Obama. In Obama's 8 years, food stamp use and the percentage in defined conditions of poverty sharply increased. The workforce shrank by more than 10 million people, though the population grew. And 23 million single Americans between the ages of 35 and 54, the prime of a person's working life, were completely idle. A great many of them were sustained on immobilizing antidepressants supplied by expanded Medicaid access. All three recent presidents had blundered in foreign policy. In the case of North Korea, that mismanagement has led to the point where the incoming administration in 2017 would be facing an imminent nuclear threat from Pyongyang. With regard to Iran, a distinct minority of Americans approved of Obama's attempt to placate the Iranian theocracy, the principal terrorism-sponsoring state in the world, with a slightly and conditionally delayed green light to deploy its own nuclear weapons. Donald Trump got around the country a great deal and had an enormous amount of contacts in almost every section of the population. He could see opinion building like a pressure cooker, especially among blue-collar conservatives, alienated not just from the direction President Obama was taking the country, but from the establishment Republican Party that was supposed to offer a political alternative. Trump himself did not take naturally to mastering policy issues, but he had a good idea of what a very large number of people were against, and he knew from his preliminary run in 1987 and again in 2000 that a third party could not win. There would be no incumbent president running in 2016, and the country was angry at both parties. Both George W. Bush and Barack Obama, by normal measurements, had been unsuccessful presidents, and the first unsuccessful presidents to be reelected. Presidents who had been unsuccessful in the past either did not seek reelection, Pierce, Buchanan, or sought reelection unsuccessfully, Van Buren, Benjamin Harrison, Hoover, Carter. Some presidents were adequately successful, but were politically outmaneuvered. John Adams and John Quincy Adams, Cleveland, Taft, George H.W. Bush. And Polk and Hayes were successful presidents, but declined to seek re-election. Trump then approached 2016 in an almost unique position, where there would not only be no incumbent, but where the American people, re-electing for a lack of other choices two unsuccessful presidents, were now looking for a dramatic change. That, he realized, offered an opening for a non-establishment candidate. Trump, however, did not spend the Obama years entirely torquing up for a possible presidential run. The coils of the casino industry were not so easily snipped. An inordinately lengthy time was required for Trump to get free from the imbroglio of Atlantic City. He was dogged by press skepticism about the proportions of his net worth, though there was no longer any question about his solvency. The casino boom in Atlantic City from which he had profited had followed the traditional path to a bust. Too many casinos were built. Neighboring states sought the same revenues and licensed their own gambling, and Atlantic City was a decrepit and somewhat out-of-the-way place. The contraction of the Atlantic City boom was painful and difficult, and Trump's casino company had gone into bankruptcy again in 2004, and the same fate appeared to be stalking it in 2009. Trump was getting too old and generally prosperous for this now, and rather than take it through the ringer of bankruptcy again, he simply retired from the company, saying that his economic interest in it was no longer material. It was an agile effort to sidestep the issue, but Carl Icahn, Trump's old and astute ally in many battles, opposed him this time. Trump was supporting a proposal, sponsored by a hedge fund, that the company go through bankruptcy yet again, but give Trump 10% of the emergent company in exchange for use of his name. Icahn led a competing offer that would remove Trump completely, adding publicly the acerbic reflection that if Trump's name was so valuable, how come they, the casinos, went bankrupt 3 times? Trump didn't answer, but Icahn's bid was unsuccessful. Relations with Icahn were patched up, and the strength of the Trump name has been demonstrated, but the casinos again went into the tank in 2011. The Trump Castle Casino was finally sold for about 8% of what Trump paid for it, though he had taken a lot of profit from it over the years, and he parked most of the capital loss on bondholders. As always when in retreat, he congratulated himself, in this case, for departing the Atlantic City casino business at the right time. The Trump Plaza and Taj Mahal casinos went back to the bankruptcy trough in 2014, as 4 of Atlantic City's 12 casinos closed in a Darwinian effort to restore commercial viability to a downsized industry. Icahn returned to the fray and gained control of these assets in 2016. By this time, he was a public supporter of Trump as a political candidate, but was guarded in his commendation of him as a businessman. It was messy, but Trump had at least got clear of it all well before there was any need to start organizing politically for 2016. The subject of Trump's wealth, not that it much matters to anyone except himself, as he is obviously a very wealthy man by the standards of all but a handful of people in the world, is difficult to assess precisely. He owns the commercial space and 3-story penthouse in the Trump Tower, the Trump Building at 40 Wall Street, a number of valuable properties on East 41st, East 57th, and East 61st Streets, all prime locations. He has a sizable interest in and the management of 1290 Avenue of the Americas, a 43-floor top-end office building, and a substantial number of very high-quality golf courses and many lucrative real estate branding and licensing agreements. He owns Mar-a-Lago, a money-spinning private club in a unique location, built from one of the greatest and most famous mansions in America. He owns parts of many other projects, none of which seem now to be controversial. It could probably be assumed that Trump has substantial other assets that are not visible, and that his income streams benefit from the most agile tax planning that can be had. The Federal Election Commission in July 2015 released filings from Trump indicating a cost value of his assets of $1.4 billion against liabilities of $265 million. But his campaign, presumably thinking it a vote winner, said that the real asset values were about $10 billion. Likely the customary truthful hyperbole, but probably not more than 2 or 3 times the real figure. He made and did not inherit billions of dollars, and became a television star and remained one for many years, and in his first try at politics was elected President of the United States. Whatever happens after this, he has already had a career of astonishing achievement, though he is still unlikely ever to lead a cotillion. Another subject that his always noisy critics focused on was his charitable endeavors. Trump frequently cites his charitable donations, and his enemies just as frequently try to debunk them. In May 2016, a long-standing critic in the New York Post, David Fahrenthold, exposed that Trump had promised to donate $1 million of his own to veterans' causes, but had not done so. There had been many stories trying to pick holes in Trump's filed claim of having donated $102 million to bona fide charities between 2011 and 2015. This was shown to include the donation of free rounds of golf at as many fine golf courses and other such prizes auctioned at charity benefits. There was particular emphasis on the donation of a free chauffeured ride given to tennis star Serena Williams to attend a tennis tournament, and the donation of a framed, autographed portrait of himself. The value of the autographed portrait was $1,136.56. Trump was understandably irritated that such an item submitted by his accounting staff should be hyped in the obsessively negative press, and angry that it overshadowed his donation of more than $100 million to certified benevolent causes. In response to Farenthold's sniping, Trump called a press conference at the Trump Tower and announced that he had successfully canvassed donations of $4.6 million for veterans' causes, and that he had, as he had promised, made a personal cash donation of $1 million to the Marine Corps Law Enforcement Foundation, bringing the total contribution to $5.6 million, short of his target of $6 million, but still a tidy sum. He handed over this total and noted that interest on the gift would quickly bring it to the campaign goal. For a man claiming such wealth, coming up with nearly $6 million did require a back-breaking charitable campaign. But he had done what he had promised and should not have been subjected to the carping insolence of penurious journalists, who are poorly qualified to judge the generosity of others. At his press conference, Trump attacked the media treatment of his charitable activities as dishonest. Frequently it was. And he singled out one television reporter as a sleaze. On normal probabilities, quite likely an accurate description. Trump was serving notice not only that he would not hesitate to attack the press as events unrolled, but that he knew how profoundly the public distrusted the media, and in his opinion, with good reason. As on several previous quadrennial occasions, speculation of a possible Trump campaign for the presidency was bruited about in the media, though it was understood that this time it would be a contest for the Republican nomination, which was thought to be wide open with no clear leading candidate for the first time since Barry Goldwater and Nelson Rockefeller contended for the honor of being buried by President Lyndon Johnson in 1964. Trump had spruced up and been more selective in his pursuit of public approval in the preceding decade. Not only were there no more ludicrously entertaining wrestling appearances, but he phased out unpromising applications of his brand and did fewer profitable but lightweight inspirational addresses. Further, he consigned to the complicated and incomprehensible attrition of litigation any and all disgruntlement over Trump University. But the polyglot army of his critics and skeptics were confidently lying in wait for him, and the more febrile opponents publicly beseeched him to test his real popularity in the field where they were both self-styled experts and presumptive kingmakers and breakers. He must make the race, comedian Stephen Colbert and others shrieked, so he could make a complete and irredeemable ass of himself, and satisfy America and the world that the country had not been battered by improvident events into seriously considering such a buffoon for its highest office. As an unfriendly duo of biographers put it, late-night comics only hoped he would stay around long enough for them to milk his candidacy for a few laughs. Almost nobody took such an initiative seriously. Trump had considered running for governor of New York in 2014, and he did not at first renew his contract with NBC for his ever-popular program, The Apprentice. Many skeptics snarkily assumed that Trump dropped hints of political ambitions merely to keep his name in the news, increase his brand visibility, and boost his ratings. The polite and civilized media, whose politeness rarely extended to Trump, accepted that Trump might be popular with up to 20% of the public, but it was not imaginable to any audible commentators, except former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who had himself given Mitt Romney a respectable run for the Republican nomination in 2012, that Trump could possibly win a series of primaries in the glare of publicity and with all the baggage he carried from past bankruptcies, indiscretions, and assorted affronts to the conventional wisdom, not to mention generally accepted versions of good taste. If the nation's greatest blowhard and most vulgar capitalist, leader of the flat-earth-level birther movement complaining that Obama was ineligible to be president, a known appreciative reader of the National Enquirer was even considering such a move, it could only be for an ultimate publicity blowout, the satiation of his own lust for publicity no matter how negative, and a stratospheric escalation of his tawdry and unlimited brand-building mania. But Trump was, in all respects, a unique candidate, and had a unique political positioning, the appeal of which his critics didn't understand. Only one person, Donald Trump, came forward to challenge the whole political establishment, to call the Bushes incompetent, the Clintons dishonest, Obama a failure, the press toadies, the pollsters flacks and lackeys, much of the financial community greedy hypocrites, and Congress a bipartisan group of self-serving and inept insiders who were just gaming the system for their own incumbencies and the devil take the country and its voters. Came the day and the man on June 16, 2015, the all-time red-letter day in the history of the Trump Tower. Trump's campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, a Republican campaign organizer in New Hampshire whom Trump had hired on the basis of a 30-minute interview, had written a campaign announcement of under 10 minutes. Trump descended the escalator of the grand foyer of the Trump Tower with Melania and his children and spoke for 40 minutes. The atrium was packed, though some may have been attracted by offers of free Trump T-shirts and hats. He was fluent, emphatic, and entertaining, and gave a foretaste of what was to come. He emphasized the issues of illegal immigration, the loss of manufacturing jobs, sacrificed to disadvantageous trade deals and an unquestioned belief in the virtues of freer trade, the skyrocketing national debt and Islamic terrorism. He accused the Obama administration, including former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, of not recognizing Islamic terrorism for what it was and of failing to defend the country adequately against it. Trump promised to finance his own campaign and severely criticized what he regarded as the corruption of the entire political system, from the buying of candidates through dishonest campaign financing to the buying of votes in Congress by lobbyists. On illegal immigration, in a country with an estimated 11 to 12 million illegal residents, Trump applied the dentist drill directly to the politically correct nerves of the left by saying that illegal immigrants from Mexico were not Mexico's best people and included inordinate numbers of drug dealers, drug addicts, rapists, and other criminal elements, though he conceded that mixed among them were, I assume, some good people. He promised a great, great wall to end the absurd porousness of 700 miles of open country without even a fence between the United States and Mexico, like the much longer but uncontroversial border with Canada. The United States, he said, had become the dumping ground for the world's problems. He promised to promote economic growth, to repatriate jobs with an incentive tax structure that would stop mollycoddling Wall Street dealmakers, to reopen and renegotiate unsuccessful trade agreements, to end the freeloading of America's so-called allies and the insolence of its enemies, and to redefine the national interest in a coherent line between George W. Bush's hair-trigger adventurism and Barack Obama's pacifistic Panglossian quest to have America's allies and enemies change roles and places. The initial reactions, entirely predictable, were mainly expressions of horror, leavened by jubilation from much of the media that the dingbat billionaire had jumped with both feet on a landmine in his first appearance. It was almost too rich a payout on their hopes for a spectacular fiasco than they had dared to imagine possible. The blowback, as Trump called it, was tempestuous. NBC ostentatiously canceled its arrangements with Trump, meaningless given that he had pulled out of The Apprentice, but indicative of the network and most other networks' invertebrate response to controversy. NBC also declined to carry Trump's beauty pageants, but he was selling out of them anyway at a handsome profit. And Macy's canceled its sale of Trump's clothing line, as his campaign announcement was inconsistent with Macy's values, a moral canon whose existence had not previously been suspected. Spanish-language networks Univision and Aura, partly owned by Mexican billionaire Carlos Slim, a large investor in the financially challenged New York Times, and NASCAR severed their tenuous connections with Trump, as did even the Serta Mattress Company, not a heavy blow to the Trump organization, all to the cacophonous jubilation of most of the media. Hillary Clinton piled on, saying, in the wake of the Charleston shooting, which happened the next day, when a 21-year-old white man shot and killed 9 people in an African-American church, that Trump had said some very inflammatory things about Mexicans. Everybody should stand up and say that that is not acceptable. This was the beginning of the mighty Democratic smear steamroller that claimed Trump supported and incited racist violence. It was an unjust but not entirely surprising charge. His comments on Mexicans were provocative, but not inflammatory. Hillary Clinton's statement, however, was the first in a long line of assertions that tended to confirm a suspicion that there was no argument to re-elect the Democrats on their merits, nor any amber waves of enthusiasm for Hillary to harvest, only the potentialities of discrediting the Republicans. At this stage, it was enough to attack a dark horse candidate for that party's nomination. A bifurcation had already begun between the conventional liberal wisdom encompassing all the Democrats and at least half of the Republicans, 80% of the national media, and 95% of the entertainment industry, and probably three-quarters of the limousine liberal community in and in close touch with Wall Street on one side, and a section of popular opinion that was not well represented in the leadership groups of the country, but was, from the first days of the Trump campaign, evidently a good deal larger and more capable of flexing its muscles at the polls than complacently received and robotically repeated civic-worthy opinion had remotely thought possible. The day before, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, son and brother of presidents, had announced his candidacy and revealed that he had a war chest of $100 million in a PAC, Political Action Committee, called Right to Rise USA. Jeb Bush was assumed to be the favorite from the start, and Trump's assurance that he would have no PAC and would accept no contributions was assumed to be irrelevant, as his campaign was not expected to last for more than a few weeks. An amusing sorbet, a circus of the bumptious, before the country got down to choosing between the latest offerings of the Bush and Clinton families that the American political class, with singular lack of originality, would be offering for its delectation this political season. Almost undetected, the political earth was starting to tremble, and a seismic shock had begun to ripple across the country. Chapter 6. Storming Babylon. The Republican Party chairman, Reince Priebus of Wisconsin, who had done a good job of cleaning up the Republicans' financial problems and getting a smooth trans-party consensus on the center-right, telephoned Trump and asked him to moderate his message, or the stresses on the party could become dangerous. Trump was hounded by the media with accusatory questions, bellowed from salivating mouths, through bared teeth and with nostrils flared. But he fairly calmly held his line, citing reasonable journalistic evidence that was not entirely easy to dismiss, and stressed that he was in favor of immigration, including Mexican immigration, but was opposed to immigration that was not applied for and accepted according to fair criteria. He opposed immigration chosen by foreigners, imposed on the United States without its approval, and especially as a means of moving criminal elements out of Mexico and other Latin American countries into the United States. Some Republican candidates agreed that it was a legitimate issue, but most rushed to join the feel-good bandwagon that the tenor of Trump's comments was unnecessarily provocative. Trump's rational response to criticism and his confident repetition of his argument, often with escalating flamboyance, quickly pushed his opponents along a path they wished in any case to follow, of demonizing him as an extremist, a racist, and a person of questionable mental stability as well as nauseating vulgarity. The Bushes and Clintons were not dynasties in the American political tradition of the Adamses, Roosevelts, and Harrisons, where the presidents were at least a generation apart and all were elevated on meritocratic grounds, and in the case of the Roosevelts, were sixth cousins, though Franklin Roosevelt's wife was Theodore Roosevelt's niece. The Bushes and Clintons emerged as quasi-dynasties because George H.W. Bush was the first president to have politically ambitious sons, since Taft and Theodore Roosevelt, and theirs didn't get a presidential nomination. And Bill Clinton was the first president to have an electorally ambitious wife. The result was that for 32 years, eight straight terms, 1981 to 2013, one or other member of the two families was president, vice president, or secretary of state. And 4 years after that stretch, the standard bearers of both families were the favored opening candidates for their party's presidential nominations. The presumption that the ascent of one or other of these heirs was foreordained left them both more vulnerable to an alternative scenario than all but a very few people saw. Donald Trump opened his active campaign right after his announcement at the Trump Tower and pulled a large crowd that packed out the auditorium in Des Moines, Iowa, and brought the crowd to its feet in complete spontaneity many times. In early July, Trump went to Phoenix, Arizona, and advanced sales required the event be moved to a bigger hall where more than 4,000 people were squeezed in like the proverbial sardines, and thousands more were outside. The response was so enthusiastic, it was a happening, and the crowd and the speaker revved each other up. Someone shouted, "Build a wall," which Trump had already promised to do, and he said, "We will take our country back." He was well aware of how he was warming the atmosphere in a state that had hundreds of thousands of undocumented Hispanics in it. An introductory speaker was the 84-year-old Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who gave part of his speaking time to the parent of a girl killed by a Mexican gang member in Los Angeles in 2008. The deceased girl's brother later disapproved of the politicization of the case, but it resonated well with the audience. Arpaio invoked Richard Nixon in saying, "The silent majority is back." Long-serving Arizona Senator John McCain said of Trump, "He fired up the crazies." This was rather insulting in a state where McCain was in a neck-and-neck race for re-election. Trump referred to McCain as a dummy, which was also uncalled for, though it was, like a great many of Trump's comments and much of his conversation, good for a laugh. A week later, answering questions from Republican pollster Frank Luntz before an auditorium of evangelical Christians in a small town in Iowa, Trump, when pressed on what he had said about McCain, attacked McCain's statement that he had been speaking to crazies. He called them all crazies. He defended his Phoenix audience, but added that McCain was a loser, one of his favorite pejorative descriptions. Luntz shouted over audience applause that McCain was a war hero. Here, Trump imprudently responded, "He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured, okay?" This was a serious discourtesy to a man who had been repeatedly tortured in 8 years as a prisoner of the North Vietnamese, and who refused early release unless all his comrades were released too. McCain's father was a distinguished admiral. Trump simply could not resist his knee-jerk impulse to counterattack anyone who criticizes him. On Lewandowski's advice, he held a press conference where the questions, on the assumption that the media could kill the candidacy, were extremely hostile. One of those present was long-shot rival candidate Mike Huckabee, former governor of Arkansas, who told his campaign aide Chip Saltzman that not only would Trump escape the McCain episode unscathed, his numbers would go up. Incredibly, they did. Polls in mid-July, after the Hillary blast and the McCain incident had reverberated heavily, showed Donald Trump leading a field of 17 candidates, all of them at least somewhat plausible. Head-scratching among the professionals of both parties began in earnest. At time of writing, it has not stopped. The first Republican candidate debate came in August 2015. And as the polls were showing Trump as the leading candidate, he was placed at the center of the group and received the first question. Bret Baier of Fox News asked if any candidate who could not pledge in advance to support the party's eventual nominee would raise a hand, and only Trump did so with the qualifier, "I can totally make that pledge if I'm the nominee." He saw the danger of doing so in a Republican audience. But as it was known that he had changed parties 7 times in 14 years, and he was running as much against the Republican establishment as against the Obama-Clinton Democrats, he felt it was both the honest and tactically preferable response. The most loaded question of the night was from the glamorous and articulate Megyn Kelly, who asked why Trump had called women fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Trump expressionlessly responded, "Only Rosie O'Donnell." And when Ms. Kelly pushed the point, Trump railed against political correctness. It was a fairly unscarred escape from the question, but Trump said after that Kelly was hostile. There was blood coming out of her eyes. There was blood coming out of her whatever. This was construed by the never-Trumpers, as anti-Trump Republicans were already starting to be called, as a vulgar reference to menstruation. but Trump responded that that was a sick interpretation, and all that he had meant was that she was very hostile. Trump had cleared the first hurdle, and while not taken seriously by the media, was obviously not going to vanish in a trice. The game began of how to quantify